so.
Professor Finkel has made a number of unique contributions to the government and foreign affairs department. One of them is to help us bridge the gulf that sometimes grows up between certain fields. He's been interested in political behavior and election, electoral behavior, but he also has been interested in the field of political theory. He's been interested in American government, but he's also studies. He most recently has begun to move in the direction of the of a focus on campaigns, and has brought to bear a rather powerful theoretical and methodological approach to this area that I think is going to yield a lot of very valuable insights. He was born in Philadelphia, a bachelor's degree from Georgetown, an MA and PhD from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's written significant studies in the fields of elections, public opinion, teaches a course this semester in public opinion, methodology, political psychology, and political theory. The titles of his works, I think, suggest the areas he's been exploring: effects of participation, relative deprivation and related psychological theories of civil violence, reassessing ideological bias in campaign participation, party identification and party registration, the difference and the consequence. So he's been taking a very hard look with all the tools and methods of political and psychological social science analysis that make possible a somewhat deeper, more penetrating study of these terribly important areas. And besides that, he's a model colleague, and it's a pleasure and a delight to work with him as all of us work with the graduate students. So we're delighted to have him.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. Very kind introduction. What I want to talk about today, it's a very hotly debated and controversial topic among people who study elections and public opinion, and that is the extent to which political campaigns, or presidential campaigns in particular, educate the American voter. After every recent election, after every campaign, you hear a lot of cries about faults of the process, reforming the process, and so on. And some common charges include the idea that campaigns are quite issueless. It's dominated by TV ads, imagery, consultants, pollsters, and the like, and the public is duped, manipulated, somehow done a great disservice by the entire process. And what I want to do here is not defend the media and defend the actions of the political candidates, because I do believe that much of what they do during campaigns is negative and possibly detrimental to the system. But if you take a look at some of the patterns in public opinion and voting behavior, which is what I do in political science, it seems to me that some of the criticisms of campaigns and the electoral process are somewhat overstated, and maybe the result of some misconceptions about the way people react to presidential campaigns. What I think would be the most important question we could ask about presidential campaigns is this: do they help create a more informed and rational electorate? That is, do they facilitate voting on the basis of important substantive issues or other substantial criteria? And although many of the critics of campaigns and most of the people who made the charges that I referred to earlier would probably say no to that question, the research that I've been doing for the last couple of years in collaboration with several of our graduate students, among them Katie Dunn, who's sitting here to my right, our answer to the question would be a guarded yes. Although there's definitely some problems with the process, and although that maybe there's not quite as much learning and so forth as well as we'd like. Campaigns definitely produce a more informed electorate at the end of the campaign than at the beginning, and also seem to encourage people to vote on important substantive grounds. And I'd be presenting a couple of the evidences and a couple of the procedures that we've used to test this. And we basically think that campaigns, instead of contributing to superficial image-oriented voting, actually help stimulate the electorate to vote on the basis of a very small set of quite reasonable criteria that the public seems to use in a series of elections in their deciding which candidate to vote for. So underneath all the hype and the hoopla and the TV ads and everything else, we think that there's a few consistent patterns in public opinion that reflect more reasonably on the process, but also point the way to some significant ways that we might improve the campaign system as well. So what I'm going to do is elaborate on some of these points, presented a little bit of a handout with some of our empirical evidence, and then think about some ways that our results might have implications for changing the system or reforming some aspects of the system. One of the major debates among political scientists in general since people started looking at the voting behavior of the electorate is whether people vote rationally. And according to a textbook approach to voter rationality, here's what the voter should do. They should look out at the candidates. They should see where the candidates stand on these issues of the day, like defense, the environment, the economy, and so forth. They should see which candidate comes closest to their particular viewpoint, and they should vote for the candidate who's closest to them. This would be the kind of model aspect of voter rationality. This way, voters sort of trying to exercise, influence public policy with their vote, and at the same time, the outcome of the election could be interpreted as a kind of mandate in terms of policy for the winning candidate. So this is kind of the ideal sense of issue voting on the part of the public, and one the kind of political scientists kind of hold them to these kind of standards to see, in fact, whether whether they do cast their votes in this manner. Is this noise in the back?
Yeah, much noise. Speak a
okay,
little louder.
Okay. Anyway, the problem from the point of view of the critics of campaigns is that many of the actors in the process don't really cooperate and provide people enough information to vote on these bases. So, for example, the mass media is commonly criticized for focusing not on substantive issues, but on the horse race aspect of the campaign, who's ahead, who's behind, the latest poll results, and so forth. And if they do talk about issues, it's often said that they talk about things that happen during the campaign itself, like the problems that Geraldine Ferraro had with her husband's finances, or Gary Hart's womanizing, and so forth. And those kinds of issues become the dominant discourse of the campaign, as opposed to more fundamental substantive issues that might be of concern to policy. Similarly, the candidates themselves know this kind of bias in the media, and so they direct their campaigns to promote these kinds of visual images, symbolic kind of things that will get their candidate, the campaigns try to get their candidate on the news, these kinds of good-looking images and so forth, and so they shy away from issue discussion as well. So these are the common arguments. What we've done is try to look at the survey data themselves and looked at some trends over the course of the last several elections and see to what extent the public actually does absorb any kind of issue knowledge during the course of the campaign. And our results are a lot more encouraging about the extent of knowledge that individuals seem to have, and especially the trends that they possess over time or they gather over time, than some of the critics might suggest. So I prepared a handout with some basic results of what we've been doing for the last couple of years. I didn't expect such a crowd today, so I don't have enough for everybody, but maybe they can share. Okay, let's see, do I need one? Yes, I have one. Everybody have access to.
She's going to mix them.
Oh, you're going to mix them up. Okay. Okay. What we've done here in this chart is to summarize some of the analyses that we've done over the past couple of months on these issues. What we do here is simply take the issues that were asked of the candidates, or asked of the respondents, excuse me, in the national election surveys in 1980 and 1984. Unfortunately, we don't have much data from 1988, which asks about these questions. So I'm using the traditional surveys that most political scientists analyzed from 1980 and 1984. For this part of the paper. Anyway, in each of these contests, voters were asked a series of policy issues, things like increasing or decreasing defense spending. Should we get tougher with the Soviet Union? Should we be more negotiating with the Soviet Union? What should we be done about the inflation versus unemployment kind of trade-off? These kinds of substantive issues of the day. And voters were asked to place themselves on these scales. They'd give them a scale where at one point would be labeled the liberal alternative, one point at the other end would be the conservative alternative. And what they would do is put themselves, where do people stand themselves on these issues? And then they would be asked where the candidates stand. Where do they think Reagan in 1980 stands on that issue? Where do they think Mondale and Reagan in 1984 stand on that issue? And so what I've done is simply construct a very basic measure of whether people have this kind of fundamental issue knowledge during the course of these campaigns. That is, a very easy criteria would be, well, do people have an opinion on it themselves? And are they able to put Reagan, generally the conservative candidate, somewhere to the right, anywhere to the right? I don't care how, if it's a lot more conservative than Mondale or Carter, or just a little bit, but do they see any kind of differences between the candidates and generally put Reagan, the conservative candidate, to the right of Carter on these scales during the campaign? And the figure that you see here on the chart should have made more, I thought I didn't realize my drawing. The figure here on the chart is simply the proportion of the number in the electorate which is correct in their perceptions of Carter's and Reagan's or Carter or Reagan and Mondale's issue stands on a majority of these issues. In 1980, we asked five issues, and so they needed to be correct on three out of the five. On 1984, there were seven issues that were asked, and so they needed to be correct on four out of the seven. So just as a summary measure, there's a lot of different ways you could present this material, but I just thought that would be an easy summary measure to take a look at. So anyway, what you see here is the proportions in three different times during the 1980 campaign and two different times, or two general periods in the 1984 campaign. And in both elections, you see in the overall column, the first row up there, you see significant improvements in the electorate's issue knowledge by the end of the campaign than at the beginning. So in 1980, for example, in January, about a quarter of the electorate satisfied these kinds of knowledge criteria. But by the end of the campaign, or towards the end of the campaign, it was closer to one half of the electorate that satisfied these kinds of knowledge, this kind of information.
Excuse me, could I ask Carson to interpret?
Uh-huh.
What do you mean by low and high TV?
This was how often people, well, I was going to get to that in a couple minutes, but I just split the sample up into do they watch TV more than four times a week, the national network news, or less than four times a week, and that was kind of the dividing line in the sample. And do you read a regular newspaper daily? And how many days a week do you read a daily newspaper? And then you have, can separate people into low and high on that basis as well. So it's pretty crude, but there's just basic dichotomies like that that maybe illustrate some of the general patterns.
That's just one interpretation.
So in any case, our overall finding is that contrary to the charge that campaigns are issueless, people don't know much about the candidates and so forth by the end of the campaign, it does appear that there's much more learning than might be expected in terms of substantive policy issues. More people are able to place the candidates on these issue scales at the end of the campaign and at the beginning, especially if you look over the course of the entire campaign, starting in the early primaries in 1980. We don't have the comparable data from 1984. And this is not just for 1980, but other political scientists before us have looked at the same kinds of patterns in 1972-76 elections as well, and you see the same general kind of trends during all these electoral campaigns, and there is definitely an increase in knowledge about the candidates and about issues by the end of the campaign than at the beginning. So this kind of charge might be a little bit exaggerated if you say that the public really isn't learning much about the issues during the contest. If you look at some of the breakdowns in terms of whether people are paying attention to the campaign, whether they're interested in the campaign, whether they follow the campaign in the media or not, then you see some even more striking differences between kinds of people and the amount of learning that does take place. So, for example, among the highly interested people, people who care about the campaign, people who report that they're very much interested in the outcome, and so forth. Over the course of the 1980 campaign, you see a very large increase in the amount of knowledge that they have over the course of the contest, compared to the low-interest people who actually decrease slightly in their issue knowledge. So they were either guessing or they forgot certain things by the end of the contest. So those kinds of differences are very clear in the electorate. If people are paying attention, if they follow the campaign on TV, if they follow it in the newspapers and so on, they care about the outcome and they care about the contest, and there's a lot more issue knowledge than there would be otherwise by the end of the campaign than at the beginning. Finally, about education, this is kind of an interesting finding. What we found here is that this is probably the most important aspect in predicting whether an individual is able to place these candidates on issues, able to understand where the candidates really stand, is the degree of education. If you look at the figures for January of 1980, you know, over a majority of college-educated individuals were able to place the candidates on the issues, compared to less than 10% of the people without a high school diploma. And so this is a very strong indication that people, there might be some need for some kind of cognitive sophistication or some kind of educational training in order to understand politics in this fashion. Moreover, over the course of the campaign, the highly educated people are always changing more than the other people. So they have the most knowledge to begin with, and they're also able to absorb more campaign information during the course of the campaign. So maybe a little bit of limitations on some part of the electorate, and so we might not expect the entire electorate to be basing their votes or judging candidates on the basis of issues because of this kind of somewhat lower level of cognitive skills and some substantial portion of the electorate. Anyway, what does all this mean for rational voting, voting rationality? We know from a large body of other research in public opinion and elections that the more knowledge people have about candidates, the more knowledge they have about the stands of the candidates on issues, the more likely it is that they're going to take issues into account in casting their vote. This is a very clear finding from a lot of different surveys dating back to the 1950s. And so what we're showing is that many more votes by the end of the campaign are therefore consistent with individuals' policy preferences as a result of what they're learning during the campaign, because people are somewhat more knowledgeable during the campaign at the end of the campaign than at the beginning, and so these people are more in a position to vote according to the issues, and they're more likely to vote according to the issues. So if your model of voter rationality is voting according to which candidate is closer to you on the issues of the day, it's clear that the campaign helps people be rational voters in that sense. So that was one major part of our inquiry, is to seeing the extent to which individuals actually learn information about issues and then use them to cast their votes by the end of the campaign. However, we also said that a lot of people are not focusing on campaigns in that fashion. They're not really able or interested in really analyzing every aspect of where candidates stand on particular issues and so on. And moreover, a lot of people are moderates. They don't really have strong stands themselves, one way or another, on the campaign. So no matter how much they learn about where Reagan or Mondale stands, they really don't have a strong preference themselves, so they're not going to be issue voters in that sense. And these are the kinds of people, the moderates, the people who are not all that knowledgeable or not all that interested in the political process. These are the people who the campaign critics think are the most vulnerable to manipulation and the most vulnerable to television advertisements and the like. And these are the kinds of people that think are maybe voting the most irrationally by the end of the campaign. And so what we've done in further part of our work is to sort of say, well, there's other ways that individuals could be rational voters besides simply canvassing all these candidates on where they stand on these every single policy issue of the day, and then kind of evaluating how far away you are from each of them and so forth. That takes a lot of effort and a lot of information on the part of the voter. We show that people do learn more about it, but there's still a large majority of the people, a larger proportion of the people who are maybe not as interested in politics in that manner. But there's other ways that individuals could vote rationally besides the ways that we were showing on this first chart. For example, political scientists have always pointed to how strong party identification is as a guide to the vote. People's long-standing party attachments that grow out of a series of elections, socialization experiences, and so on. And, you know, it's rational for the person to kind of rely on their party affiliation because it gives you a pretty good guide of where the candidate's going to stand, what the candidate's going to do in office. You don't need to be monitoring every single aspect of the campaign and every single movement and evaluating it. You can sort of cut your costs of gathering information by simply relying on your long-standing preference for one of the other parties. So this is a clear major factor in predicting how individuals are going to vote, and also, as we'll see in a second, how campaigns develop and how public opinion develops during campaigns also. Another aspect of maybe more directly relevant for rational choice behavior on the part of the public is a series of attitudes that have to do with the economy and how things are going in the country at the time of the election. That is how the national economy is doing, how well the incumbent president is doing in terms of managing the economy, how well the incumbent is doing in terms of keeping the country at peace, and managing other important national problems. And from the point of view of a rational voter, if things are going well in the country and things are looking pretty good and the economy is moving along, the president seems to be in control, then the rational thing to do is keep the person in office, vote for the incumbent party. If things are going poorly, if the economy's not doing so well, if the president doesn't appear to be in control of the machinery of government, then throw the rascal out. And this is a long-standing tradition in voting behavior research, and identified by V.O. Key, one of the first people, one of the giants of the field of voting behavior. And he identified it as referendum voting, a referendum on the state of the economy or on the incumbent president. And he called the American electorate a rational god of vengeance and reward. So somewhat dramatic imagery for a political scientist, but anyway, gets the point across that people are using their vote as terms of a reward and punishment kind of behavior. So from this point of view, these are the kinds of things that really drive elections, these kind of predisposition. I call them predispositions of the voter, that people enter the campaign with. General party attachments and a general sense of how the economy and how the country as a whole is going. And what I've been doing and what we've been doing for the last couple of years is trying to see to what extent campaigns draw out these kinds of predispositions, or what the relationship is between these kinds of general orientations of the individual and the way they ultimately vote in national elections. And the results, I think, show some interesting ways about how campaigns actually develop and change public opinion. First of all, one major finding about these kinds of predispositions is that you can predict very, very well how an individual is going to vote by asking him or her what party they generally attach themselves to, and these questions about what they think about the state of the national economy and how they think the president is performing in terms of managing the economy and other national problems. You can predict the individual's votes extremely well. You could also measure these attitudes very early in the campaign. What I've done in an earlier paper is measure them in June of the election year. That is, even before the major candidates are nominated by their conventions, and you ask the voter how things are going in the country. Do you think things are going well or poorly? How the national economy is going? How well the president is performing? And their general long-standing party attachment. And what I did was I was able to predict well over 80% of the votes of the electorate, how they would eventually vote based on the knowledge of these kinds of predispositions that were measured very early in the campaign. What you could also do is then predict the overall outcome of the election by summing up sort of all of the individual's predispositions. And what I showed in the other paper was that in every election of the 1980s, you could use this technique and come very, very close to the actual outcome of the vote. That is, in 1980, I came very close to Reagan getting a large majority of the two-party vote. 84, also Reagan very close. In 88, even at the time when Dukakis had his lead in the surveys in the early summer, using the predisposition model based on these kinds of rational factors, the model predicted a 52% Bush victory. And, of course, he won with a little over 53% of the vote. So it was pretty close in terms of using the electorate's basic predispositions to predict the outcome of the election, even before a lot of the media hoopla and advertising and so forth took place. So the conclusion that I drew from that was that what happens during campaigns is that those kinds of predispositions are drawn out. They're naturally brought out by the campaign, by the discussion in the campaign, by the events of the campaign. It leads people into voting more consistently with their underlying dispositions of how the country is going at that particular time. And that seems to be a somewhat rational approach on the part of the electorate in terms of rewarding and punishing incumbents, and also a positive function that campaigns seem to serve is of drawing out those kinds of fundamental attitudes and fundamental orientations. What we've done in this, in further extension of that general idea, and what you see on the table two, the second table, on the next page, is to see to what extent these predispositions shape how people develop attitudes towards the candidates over the course of the campaign. That is, how these predispositions, general party attachments and approval or disapproval of the incumbent, how they shape changes in the public's attitudes towards the candidates over time. And this is a really interesting table, I think, because it says a lot about exactly what happened in the 1988 election when Dukakis had a reasonable lead back in the early summer and then lost it by the end of the campaign. What you see here is, what I did is I used ABC Washington Post polls on this one because the traditional political scientists surveys were not.
Wilson, no problem.
Professor, when you were being introduced, there was an inordinate amount of hammering next door, and I misunderstood the word that was describing some of your accomplishments. I think it was methodology, and I caught it because of the noise as mythology.
Some people do, even if they hear it correctly, they get it out.
And I'd like to draw a distinction here between questions and inquiries. I have a couple of orientation inquiries to make about this. What was the sample of this, the aggregate of the sample?
This was... Well, there was about 900 people in 1980, and in the 1984, there was about 3,500.
And the polling was done by mail, or by personal interview, or by telephone?
Personal interviews. All the Michigan studies are based on what Ken was saying, the University of Michigan studies, and they're all done face-to-face. These are all from the Survey Research Center at the University of Michigan. They're the ones who keep the depository of political science data, and so they make them available to the general public.
I won't pursue that line of inquiry further then, because I know of the Michigan thing and the structure there. Surveys in a way supposedly to offset any input bias. But there are a couple of things here that I, looking at the educational factor here, these surveys were made during, immediately prior to election, presidential elections, in which in each instance the Republican candidate was successful. I don't know whether that indicates a bias, but the thing that strikes me is the no high school degree, the understanding of the issues doubled in the 1980 between January and September.
Mm-hmm.
And it doubled again between the fall of 80 and the fall of 84. I'm referring to the no high school degree. Is that in any way related to the alleged superior capability of Mr. Reagan as a communicator?
I hadn't thought of it in that way. I think that the jump from 1980 to 1984 is probably the result of a more liberal Democratic candidate running against Reagan, whereas Carter kind of was in the middle in a lot of things and tried to obscure really where he stood. Mondale was a clear liberal, and so I think the public in general, everybody in the public perceived more clear differences in 1984 than they did in 1980. Whether I could look at whether no high school degree people were more likely to be accurate on Reagan's stance than on Mondale's, maybe take them separately, and that would be a good test of what you're suggesting. Yeah. And I think I have that in the reams of printouts that usually generate papers, but I could look at that. I don't know the actual answer to that.
One last inquiry or comment was, when I think of, in some of our elections, there are only 33% of the 33 or 36% of the registered voters vote. I don't know what percentage of the registered voters are without high school degrees, but on the highest, when I think of at one time, 7% of those didn't understand the issues. Is there an estimate of the electorate of what percentage of voters are without high school degrees?
The strongest factor that predicts whether a person is going to vote or not is the education level.
Counting noses.
Yeah, I know that the likelihood of you voting if you're less than a high school degree is about 30%, and the likelihood of you voting if you have a college degree is about 80%. So of the people who are in the electorate, I would say there's a strong disproportionate number of them who have college degrees, and a very smaller number than in their population. So if there's, I don't know the exact number of high school and less people in the population, I'd say maybe 15% or so, probably in the voting.
Have college degrees.
No, about 25% have college degrees, but in the voting electorate, probably about 50%, maybe 35% have college degrees.
The worst case is in that 75% of that 36% who do vote don't know what the issues are.
That might be a little overstated, but they say a strong, significant number of people who are in the electorate don't know what the issues are. That's true. But, as I tried to say, that doesn't mean they don't know where the candidate stands on, say, defense spending. They don't know where the candidate stands on what to do about the environment. But they still have these kinds of general impressions of how the economy's going, how the president's performing in office, those sorts of things, which are reasonable ways of casting your vote as well, which I tried to bring out. So issue knowledge is one thing, and of course educated people are much more likely to be oriented that way, but other bases are also possible. So because they don't know everything about the issues, I don't think it's a cause for concern, but not a cause to really throw up our hands and say that the electorate's irrational or doesn't know what they're doing. So that would be...
To give it a final light touch, the liberal would say that the lack of knowledge of the issues is the reason the Republicans have been elected in the last two presidential campaigns.
Well, that's common, that the losing side always seems to say people aren't voting according to the issues. And if everybody knew the issues, they'd obviously elect the candidate of their particular preference. But we have looked at some data which suggests that in 1984, for example, on these issues, the electorate on average was closer to Mondale than Reagan. Mm-hmm. So had there been an issue referendum, Mondale would have won 1984 election. But because it was a performance referendum on how things were going, the economy, Reagan's job performance, then of course Reagan was able to overcome that. In 1988, however, Bush was slightly closer to the electorate than Dukakis. So no matter which way you look at it, in 1988, performance of the president, economic performance, or straight issues, so Bush probably had the edge in that one.
There's one other bit of mythology in addition to the one Mr. Newman mentioned, and that is that younger scholars know all the answers, and that older ones realize that they don't know anything. Well, Professor Finkel is somewhere in between. He knows quite a few of the answers,
age
but he's
answer.
Still he's still looking for a number of the answers, and that makes this kind of inquiry, I think, terribly interesting. So thank you very much.
Thank you.